Want to welcome some students with us today. We have Banner Preparatory School. Would those students please stand? We're glad to have you with us today. You may be seated. And we have students from St. Francis High School. Would they please stand? We're glad to have you with us today, too. You may be seated. Students are here with a program called Court with Class. High school students are across the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. The invitation is accepted. Then the students are sent materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. Students come to oral argument. And then we'll meet with a justice of the court after this argument. And the subject of the discussion will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case that they have heard. So we welcome all of you. Now, is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear? Easier to listen and understand if you have an idea about the facts and the law. Well, let me introduce my colleagues to you. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and he is the justice assigned today to speak to the students. And to his left is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, which is 09AP2007D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Kyle Torvinen. Arguing on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Attorney Wayne A. Arnold. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. I am Wayne Arnold of Rice Lake, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation as retained counsel. We are here on appeal from the referee's decision in a case involving Attorney Kyle Torvinen of Superior with reference a claim conflict of interest, Rule 1.9, duties to a former client. OLR alleges two counts manifested by Mr. Torvinen's direct representation of clients adverse to a former client of the firm and his supervision of subordinate staff who did the same as the second count. The question before the court is, in analyzing 1.9, are the two cases handled by the Torvinen firms the same or substantially related? The two cases in time sequence, and I might also mention that any references I make to things in the record are in the brief. I will make no citations to the record that are not cited in the brief. The two cases that we are involved with that were handled by the Torvinen firm, the first one was handled by Mr. Torvinen's then associate, now partner, Mr. Jones. It was a commercial real estate purchase transaction for clients by the name of Chavez. They were interested in purchasing an old corner filling station, since converted to a laundromat, and Mrs. Chavez wanted to use the filling station as a hair salon. Mr. Jones represented the Chavez's in that purchase, and in primarily what's important for our analysis for our analysis is that he handled the items pertaining to quiet use, enjoyment, and occupancy of the premises. He did the title work. He attended the closing of that purchase transaction. And as Mr. Jones described the purchase transaction, it was very like, or I think he described it as a garden variety real estate purchase transaction, the same as hundreds of such transactions that occur throughout the state every day. Shortly after the closing in that purchase transaction where Mr. Jones represented Mr. and Mrs. Chavez, the immediate next door neighbor to the property they had just purchased came over, and immediately an issue arose over a parking lot lease that the neighbor had upon the premises just purchased. Essentially, the claimed parking lot lease, which, by the way, was drafted some 10 years earlier, I think, a substantial length of time earlier by another member of the Torvenin firm. The parking lot lease essentially gave the neighbors, two chiropractors, use of undefined parking spaces on the Chavez property. And this arose immediately after the purchase transaction, and the chiropractor neighbors went to Mr. Torvenin to have him represent them in trying to work out first some accommodation of the parking lot lease. Will they abide by it? Will they extend it? And ultimately, when that was not fruitful, Mr. Torvenin directed a new associate in the firm, which there is no dispute. In fact, they've stipulated that Mr. Torvenin was supervising new attorney Kirk, who had only been in practice perhaps a year, year and a half at this point in time, that everything she did in filing this lawsuit against the Chavezes was Mr. Torvenin's responsibility. That's been stipulated. So the question is, are those two matters the same or substantially related? We believe that they are substantially related, first because Mr. Jones represented the Chavezes, and in the course of his purchase, commercial property purchase representation, did what lawyers do in making sure that the Chavezes had the quiet use, enjoyment, and occupancy of the premises.
Counselor, is the lease a recorded lease?
No.
Then you wouldn't find it when you did title work, right?
That's correct. Okay.
But if you looked into your own files, you'd find it.
I'm sorry?
But if you looked into your own files, you would find it.
One would expect that it is in the Torvenin firm files somewhere, and also two attorney witnesses from the Torvenin firm said that they did have a conflict check system. I believe it was in some transition from being a paper conflict transaction or a conflict system into a computerized conflict check system.
You know, go ahead. Let me ask, is it anticipated that a firm that has a conflict check system operative, that if the focus would be a 10-year earlier transaction, that in and of itself, does that in and of itself, would that have created conflict in this case? Am I making myself clear? I'm stumbling a little on the question. It just seems to me that I'm not sure how reasonable it is
to say, hey, they should have found that in the file or they should have had that on their system 10 years ago, and there should have been a red flag then with regard to Jones representing Chavez. Is that reasonable or not? What do you think?
I don't disagree, and in fact, OLR does not take the position that the fact that the parking lot lease in and of itself, having been drafted by the Torvenin firm, is the huge conflict issue. It's a complicating factor. Mm-hmm. But what OLR believes that makes this a conflict, a very obvious conflict, is when the parking lot lease could not be resolved amiably and Mr. Torvenin brought suit against the Chavezes being the people Mr. Jones had represented in the purchase transaction, concerning the very same real estate about which or over which the parking lot lease allegedly applied to. They alleged in their lawsuit complaint at paragraph 10, and I won't do a lot of quoting, but I do want to quote this one paragraph because I think it's significant. The Torvenin complaint on behalf of the neighbors against the Chavezes, that on or about February 19, 2007, the closing date of the Chavez purchase, that on or about February 19, 2007, defendants, the Chavezes, became successors in interest to Robert J. Rule, the seller of the property, pursuant to a warranty deed recorded on March 8, 2007 at the Douglas County Register of Deeds, recorded as documents such and such. At all times, defendants were fully aware of the lease and its terms and conditions. Now, whether or not they were aware of the terms and conditions of that lease, I mean, that is really the subject of the lawsuit. The point is, though, that they're putting at issue, or in issue, the terms and the circumstances of the property purchase that his partner had represented the Chavez's on. That's what makes it a conflict, primarily, in our view, by the very lawsuit itself. That, we think, makes it a conflict beyond any shadow of a doubt, let alone by our clear satisfactory standard.
Why did you look for a private reprimand instead of just a warning letter? Because, as I read it, which you should correct if my reading is wrong, you have the Chavez's coming in. They ask for what form could they use to buy real estate. Lawyer tells them they can buy such and such a form and where to buy it. They come back and they want him to fill it out, right?
Yep, you have the sequence correct.
Okay. So he comes back, he fills it out, and my sense is that the clients are in a hurry and they don't want to pay too much, so they don't want him to do too much. Just sort of a quickie. And so he views himself as a scrivener, fills it out, and the offer is then accepted, right? The offer is then accepted.
Yes.
And then within a short time before closing, Chavez's come back and say, hey, the other side's got a lawyer. Maybe we better have a lawyer at closing, right?
That's correct.
And the firm, again, represents him at closing, a few hours, a couple hours, 3 hours. And so money passes and a deed is done. It's a very limited scope representation. I mean, that's the argument, is it?
Disagree slightly with that.
Pardon me? Yeah, that's why I'm asking you. Okay. And I refer to it as unbundled legal services, if it's true. But limited scope is the more recent terminology for this. Go ahead.
In terms of the factual sequence, which you had accurately stated, I think at first Mr. Jones understood the Chavez's to be asking just simply for a form. And and as lawyers will do, so if you're looking for just a form, you can go down to the stationery store.
I used to just give it to them.
I'm sorry?
I used to just give it to them for the quarter or the nickel that it was involved. I'd say, here, you want the form? Be my guest. I'd figure they'd come back for a will. They'd have an auto accident. Go ahead.
But it evolved beyond the simple form. In other words, I think the reasonable inference from that sequence of events is they did not go to the stationery store. They said, no, after he explained maybe the pros and cons of getting a form from the stationery store, they said, okay, we will hire you to draft an offer to purchase. And then they came into his office, and he had a computerized commercial offer to purchase on his computer, and he picked and chose provisions, paragraphs, to accommodate, to better customize the kind of offer that they needed, given what they told him about the kind of property they were purchasing. So, it then left the simple form.
Did he check the property to go down to the assessor's office and get an assessment, evaluate the terms of the value of the property? Did he check zoning? Did he check whether there are any outstanding liens on the property? Did he do any of that?
As to the last point, that was checked at closing because there was a title policy.
No, but before, when he made the offer to purchase. No, he didn't do any of that.
I don't believe so. I think the initial conference with the Chavez's and Mr. Jones was in drafting a custom commercial offer to purchase, which they took with them, and he then billed that out.
Okay.
So limited to that extent. The other issue, which you probably see in the briefs, and in fact the referee adopted it, the 1.2 limited representation that's actually recognized in the rules. I disagree with that conclusion of law, because to fall under, shall we say, large L limited 1.2, you have to have a heads up to the client about the pros and cons, which I can't tell that there was any of that kind of exchange between Mr. Jones and the Chavez's. In other words, I think to fall under the rule, one has to comply with the rule and have that heads up, if you will, about the pros and cons of such limited representation. But small L limited representation, I guess, it's up to our own definition.
Your position is this is not limited representation. It was representation in full. And then you got him representing Chavez in this land deal. And the land deal that he represented Chavez in is substantially related to the problem about the lease.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the last part of that.
I'm trying to get to what you think is substantially related. I am assuming that what you think is substantially related is representing Chavez in buying this property.
Right.
Is substantially related to later litigation involving a lease on this property.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the two that are substantially related.
However, I've already explained why I don't think it's under large L limited that's under rule 1.2. But however you want to describe Jones's representation of Chavez, I guess first of all I would go to Mr. Jones's characterization of it as your garden variety real estate purchase representation, the same as happens hundreds of times around the state. We would agree that it is somewhat more limited than some forms of representation, still in all, it did not reduce down below the kinds of things that Mr. Jones did for the Chavezes, which ended up triggering the same or substantially related. And that is, he did spend time at the closing on free occupancy use of the premises. And in fact, he canceled another lease, which got a little confusing. There was another lease in existence that came up or was discussed at the closing, where the seller of the property had a corporation that ran the laundromat, and he had a lease between his shell corporation and himself. And Mr. Jones said, we want to make sure that that's canceled, because he was concerned about his clients, the Chavezes, having peaceful use occupancy of the property. And in fact, I think it came a little later after closing, but the seller attorney did send a cancellation of that lease as requested by Mr. Jones. So he was doing what people hire lawyers to do, primarily, I think, in purchase transactions, is to make sure you got clear title.
Counsel, my understanding is that the underlying dispute between the purchasers of the building and the chiropractors was resolved for, I think the record says, $750. Is that true?
That's right.
And do you suppose that's one of the factors that led Judge Erickson in his recommendation to write the following sentence? Quote, in regard to this whole matter, quote, I consider it all to be the equivalent of the old proverbial tempest in a teapot, end quote. Do you think that was one of the factors? If I had to speculate, I would say maybe he looked at the end result here.
You know, I guess we would all have our own views of that.
And then my question to you then, if your answer to that question is no, my question to you would be, if you had to speculate as to the reasons for Judge Erickson to have written that, what would some of the factors be that he might have relied on?
I don't know. I mean, I find the lawsuit that Mr. Torvonen brought against the Chavezes very strange, because by the time it got filed on October 4, the lease was ending that December 31st. I mean, what's the point? By its terms of the lease, although it started, I think, in 1997, some, 9 years earlier, it was ending December 31st, 2007. And the purchase closing was in on February 19th of 2007. Then, the give and take over the discovery of the lease and the discussions. And then ultimately the lawsuit that Mr. Torvonen filed was on October 4, and the answer wasn't in from the Chavezes and filed until October 23rd, and I've got 60 days left on the lease. I mean,
Is it the suing that's the objection of OLR, or is it the whole representation?
It's Mr. Torvonen's representation of clients adverse to the Chavezes.
So whether he sued or not was irrelevant.
Well, the lawsuit and the claim in the complaint is extremely important on whether it's the same or substantially related.
I understand that. But that he's filed a lawsuit or not is not the kicker.
That would not be... If a lawsuit was not filed, I believe it would still be a conflict, because they are talking about the circumstances of the property purchase. Because one of the things at issue was the parking lot lease brought up at closing? Because, of course, if it was brought up, then, you've got a whole different analysis about whether the Chavezes were obligated or not. Or not under it. If it was not brought up at closing and it's not recorded, where are the parties then? I mean, it's a different sort of legal analysis. The parking lot lease and its resolution was focusing on the very closing that Mr. Torvonen's partner represented the Chavezes on. I mean, it's just a classical example of a conflict of interest that always, they always blow up in the attorney's face.
Let's for the moment assume that a lawyer has to decide whether it's the same or substantially related, right? I mean, that's a decision you have to make. And it's not always an easy decision. I've been there, done that, right? Okay. And you've probably been there and done that too. So, according to this record, if I've got it right, Mr. Tuovinen consulted with his partners. They checked it out. They thought about it. It's not as if they didn't care. They did care, right?
Well, they were caring for Laughlin and Lang to the exclusion of Chavez.
Well, that's your
yes.
conclusion. My conclusion is that they recognized a problem and explored whether it was a real problem or that it was not substantially related and that there was enough separation here.
I think that kind of analysis has to be done in good faith, and it has to be reasonable under the facts, because otherwise every law firm in the state is going to go into the library and decide that their partner's behavior is within the rules, and goodbye OLR and goodbye Supreme Court.
We can't have that, right? Because they have an economic interest in wanting to keep the case, right? I mean, that's your point.
I actually don't think it was driven by economic. I think it was driven by friendship and loyalty.
Okay. In this case, it was friendship and loyalty. The next case, it may be money. In the third case, it may be looking for some future business. But there's another factor, is what your point is here.
Well,
when did they pull out of the case? Ultimately, they pulled out, right?
At first, Mr. Tuovinen withdrew after the OLR investigation commenced and the investigator contacted the firm. Then he talked to his clients, Lang and Laughlin, and withdrew his withdrawal, and then later withdrew a final time, and his Lang and Laughlin, the people he was most loyal to, as it always happens in when you take a conflict of interest, they end up getting hurt because they've got to hire a lawyer who has to get in midstream, which no lawyer likes to do. So they get hurt. So not only are the Chavez's feel betrayed at the beginning, angry, bad-mouthing the profession, his closer friends, if you will, end up hurt as well. And, that's the essence of a conflict of interest.
Well, what brownie points do you give for the lawyer being concerned, checking it out, talking to OLR, withdrawing? Take that into consideration, either whether there was a violation, or do you take it into consideration in the sanction, or not, neither?
I think you asked me a sanction question earlier, which I didn't respond to. And you have me in a disadvantage there because as retained counsel, I get the case after, and I see my time has expired, so I'll answer.
You may
respond.
May
answer the question. I get the posture of the case that comes to any retained counsel is it has been found to have probable cause by the preliminary review committee. It comes to you as counts, of course, with the relevant rule cited, and the sanction has been determined by the director, and I think that just has to be the case because otherwise you would have individual retained counsels without the broader perspective.
You lack uniformity.
Exactly. Thank you. My time's expired.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Hendricks, you represent the respondent.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, good morning. My name is John Hendricks. I'm of counsel for the 115-year-old firm, Superior Law Firm of Knudsen, Tuovinen, Jones, and Kirk, the successor firm of the firm that was in existence at the time of this incident. With me today is Kyle Tuovinen, the respondent, and other members of the firm, Paris Jones, Mitch Roth, and Ilana Kirk. Mr. Knutson would have been here, but he had an extreme family tragedy occur, and he had to back off and attend to that. I welcome the opportunity this morning to come and talk and discuss with you the reasons for what I consider to be a meritless disciplinary matter. Let me indicate to you, I think there are four major reasons that this appeal and the charges against Mr. Torvanen should be dismissed. The first of these is the report of the referee. The second of these is the fact that Director Saleen indicated in a phone conversation with respondent and Mr. Knutson that the matter would be concluded if he withdrew, and he did. The third reason I think this matter should be dismissed, and we'll discuss with you, is the withdrawal of Mr. Torvanen. And the fourth reason are the facts of this matter just don't support a disciplinary action. As Justice Gableman talked about this being a tempest in a teapot, I think it helps to put this in some context. This is not a matter where there wasn't a cooperation. There was total cooperation here. It isn't a matter of dishonesty. It isn't a matter of fraud. And as you pointed out, Justice, this matter was settled a couple months after the withdrawal of the respondent for $750 by substitute counsel. So far, I expect the OLR has expended well over $10,000 in this prosecution. And you can be sure that Mr. Torvanen, while he hasn't had the outlay, since he's been able to get folks like myself for nothing, has expended a like amount of time, though. Now, the posture of this matter is that the Chief Justice appointed a retired circuit judge, James Erickson, to hear this matter. OLR brought the matter. We had a day-long hearing in Superior, Wisconsin. They called all the witnesses they wanted. They called every single one of the folks that is here except for Mitch Roth, and they called Mr. Knutson. They put in all the exhibits. I think you folks are aware of that from the records. The hearing went on for a day. And then when all was said and done, Judge Erickson, he'd been on the bench for about 18 years when he retired, hearing all kinds of things, I suspect, in Polk County, Wisconsin, criminal matters, civil matters, domestic matters. But he was a judge. He was familiar with making decisions on what attorneys presented. And what happened in this case? What was the result of Judge Erickson's decision? He indicated to you folks that not only had they failed in their burden of proof by proving by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence, they hadn't carried the day in that. Not only didn't they carry the day in that, and he indicates the matter should be dismissed, but he in fact concluded from that day-long hearing and all the exhibits, he concluded that Mr. Torvanen and his firm should be commended for what they did in this case. So I would submit to you.
What did they do that he's commended them for? What did he do that the judge commended him for?
I think the reason he decided that they, Mr. Torvanen and the firm should be commended, Chief Justice, is the fact that in the course of this matter, when it came up, this firm, they sat down, they talked about it. This firm has a history of being involved in ethical situations. I had been on the BAPR investigative deal up in District 11. My mentor had been. Another partner had been. And this firm was very ethically concerned about matters. And when this matter came up, they sat down. I think the record shows that Johanna indicates they got out the book, they went over it, and I think the judge was impressed by the fact that they talked about it, that they analyzed it. I think in one of his findings, he indicates that the firm talked about it ad nauseum because they wanted to be sure there wasn't a problem, that what they did was ethical. They were concerned about that, and I think he was impressed by the fact that they did that and accordingly thought the firm should be commended for that. The next part that I want to talk about is, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but in the course of this, as a part of the concern, Torvanen and Knutson contacted Director Saleem. They were concerned about that. They talked to him about it. They tried to, because the investigation was ongoing, they wanted to know what was going on. And you have to put this in the context. This is in the context of a scheduling conference. Up until this point, nothing had really happened in this. There had been some preliminary discovery, but really nothing had happened. But there was a scheduling conference coming up, and they contacted Director Saleem, and they got the impression from him that if Torben...
This was after the complaint had been filed.
The complaint by...
OLR.
No.
Well, what kind of scheduling conference are you talking about? What kind of scheduling conference?
The scheduling conference for the lawsuit that Torben and
okay.
I'm sorry, Judge. They started that action in October, right. And, okay. And the scheduling conference was in that litigation.
Right.
But
got
before
it.
He went forward, before they went forward, they talked to there was this concern. They talked to him, and they got the impression from him, rightly or wrongly, but there's never been a dispute. And in fact, Judge Erickson found that they got that impression. That if they withdrew, if Torvenen withdrew, then the matter would be dropped. And he immediately withdrew. And he confirmed that with a letter to Director Saleem. And I would submit that that's the second reason this thing should be dismissed. The third reason, and I think it came up in some of the questionings that you folks were talking about, has to do with withdrawal in this matter. And this has confronted, I think, almost every judge and or attorney. You get into a matter, and you think you know it, but you find in the course of discovery or sitting on a bench that there are things that you didn't know and you didn't anticipate, and you try to do that, but it just is impossible. And I think the rules, and I think it's SCR 2116, anticipates this because it talks about the fact that after representation, you may have to, or you may be able to withdraw because the situations evolve over time. And so with that confrontation, and then Judge Erickson finds that there wasn't any harm, there wasn't any prejudice to anybody here, and Torvenen withdrew, what are we here for? What did he do wrong? The facts of the matter, no matter how you view those facts, he got out of the matter. He did what attorneys across the state of Wisconsin regularly do after you've been in a matter, and you say, there's a problem here, real or imagined, or it may be an appearance problem, you withdraw. And in this case, he not only withdraw after they concluded, four attorneys in the firm and the referee concluded that there wasn't any merit to it, that there wasn't a violation of the code, he still withdrew. And so what is gained here? What is gained by disciplining a person when there's been no harm, there's been no prejudice? The rule doesn't say you have to immediately withdraw. So you have to think about what would be reasonable. What would be reasonable under the circumstances? And I would submit to you.
Counselor, you'll have to stand. That's fine. You have to stand in front of the microphone when you speak. You can drink your water that way. That's no problem. No problem.
And to be honest with you, Judge, most people, my voice is so piercing that they can hear me through walls and doors. So.
Question is whether the recording device can hear you.
Okay.
I hear you fine.
All righty.
Counselor, I think the question here is whether the representation was substantially similar. And I understand from what's been submitted, you believe it was not substantially similar. You want to give me your best argument about why the purchase involvement that Attorney Jones had was not substantially similar to the representation in regard to this lease?
Certainly, Judge.
Thank you.
The actual, I think, believe language is substantially related. They need to be substantially related.
Okay.
And they're not substantially related for various reasons, but here are some of them. The one was a purchase transaction. The other one was a land dispute transaction. The one involved the Chavez's and Rule, the purchaser. The second one involved Laughlin and Chavez's. The one, this lease that became the subject matter of the litigation wasn't even brought up at the purchase transaction. The people, when they went to the purchase transaction and the OLR stipulated to this, didn't even know this lease existed. It had never been recorded. It had been an agreement, between Rule and Lang originally. And then Chavez stepped into the shoes of Rule, the seller, and Laughlin, who was a plaintiff in the lawsuit, stepped into the shoes of Lang. But this thing wasn't even known about. These are two independent things. They stand on their own. They're not related. The litigation could have gone ahead whether the purchase transaction had happened. The purchase transaction could have occurred without the litigation being involved.
What about the allegation that I heard earlier relating to paragraph 10 of the complaint in the land dispute, which seems to indicate that there was some knowledge? What's your response to that?
You mean the allegation that the defendant knew about the lease?
Absolutely.
I think there's two things that can be said about that. The way that paragraph in the complaint, that's A, not very unusual language to find in a complaint. You say that the defendant knew something for a period of time. It would be, of course, subject to proof. But in any case, it referred, as I understand it, as I read the complaint, it referred to the period of time after the dispute. This dispute arose, as I recall, in March. The closing was in February of 07. The dispute arose in March of 09. The fence went up, I think, on the 26th. That created the real hot spot was the fence because it blocked off the view of these people. And I think that allegation that they knew about it all the time was in terms of Laughlin, when he had talked to Torvonen, indicated these people, they had a copy of the thing. But it hadn't come up at the closing, so that Jones wasn't aware of that. And if we're imputing what Jones knew to Torvonen, and that's part of the idea here, I believe, is then Torvonen wouldn't have known about it either. But he did know that from the time that the Chavez's went into possession, that they knew about the lease, they had the lease, they showed the lease to Laughlin. I think there's testimony to that effect in the record. So that's what I believe that allegation has to do with.
Counsel, as a follow-up to Justice Rogenczak's question, why not substantially related, or as she said, give us your best shot, I look at it that the purchase transaction is a transaction to convey clear title, and the land dispute transaction is that there was a problem with the conveyance of clear title here. So isn't that substantially related? It seems like it to me.
I can understand that there seems to be some relationship in the way those facts are. And there is a relationship in that the dispute arises over the land that was involved in the purchase. But the dispute came out of the blue. Nobody knew that there was going to be a dispute at the purchase transaction. And there was some discussion in the first part of this argument about the representation of Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones, he had no chance. There was no abstract here. There was nothing in the title for him to know. And these people called him up at the last minute to come down and attend the closing. The law offices were even closed that day.
Counsel, I don't see the focus really as a conflict between Mr. Jones in the February 07 transaction and 10 years ago what happened with regard to the drafting of the lease. I see the focus of the conflict with the purchase transaction in February of 07 and the land dispute which came to fruition 2 years later.
And I think that's OLR's point too. I think that there hasn't been, as I think he indicated, the old lease that had been drawn by my partner Knudsen. That wasn't what OLR indicated was they felt was the part that created the disciplinary problem. It was the incident between Mr. Jones and Mr. Torvonen starting his lawsuit, the closing in 07, and the fact that he started the lawsuit in the fall of 07.
What should the court do if, assuming there's some substantial relationship here, but there was also, it appears by the findings of the referee, an earnest attempt to evaluate it, whether or not there was a conflict, and ultimately there was a withdrawal. If the court decides that there is a conflict, under these facts, what should the court do?
It should dismiss this matter.
Why?
Because it doesn't matter how you view the facts. He withdrew from the matter. Let's say there is the biggest conflict in the world. He found out it and he decided, let's say they made their evaluation in October, and they started this litigation, and they got into the matter, and then they had, on reflection, they decided, you know, there is a conflict here, but we're going to get out of it. And that's happened to almost every active attorney in the state of Wisconsin. They realize on reflection, for whatever the reason may be, there's a conflict and they withdraw. And as long as there hasn't been any prejudice attached or any harm, they withdraw, and they should be able to withdraw. And the code recognizes that. The code recognizes it because it talks in terms of once representation is started, they under some circumstances have to withdraw, and I would submit they do withdraw, and they think that cures and corrects the problem, and it does.
Let me ask that, because from your earlier comments, that's where I thought you were headed, that even if there was a conflict, that withdrawal here cures it? Is that what you're advising?
That's exactly. That's part of my argument. That's one of the reasons I think the matter should be dismissed, because no matter how you look at the facts, no matter if you find that it is substantially related, I think the fact that Mr. Torvonen withdrew solves the problem. Attorneys across the state, if you don't believe that, if the court rules the other way, I would submit to you, you should let the attorneys know, and you should rewrite the rule they know that.
Let me ask, though, because that's a bit of a quandary. Attorneys across the state are in the very situation that you described. They get in a little deeper than they thought it was going to be okay. They thought that, oh, people can just work it out. Here, you write I'll give you a letter, you send it. And then they get in a little deeper, and ultimately they withdraw because the level of comfort is reaching too high on the neck. Discomfort is reaching too high on the neck. So you have that. That's a common occurrence. But on the other hand, if we say, okay, in a certain fact situation, let's forget this, there's a clear and ongoing and blatant conflict of interest. Any fifth grader should see this, and they don't withdraw until months and months later. For us to say withdrawal cures conflict causes some problems too in our jurisprudence. So what do we do about that?
Well, I would submit that I think the analysis should be in terms of what has the continuation, what problems has it caused. If they don't withdraw for months and months and months, I suspect there's been a delay problem. And the delay problem is a consequence that maybe shouldn't be tolerated. But where they withdraw, and there's a finding by the referee in this matter that there was no harm and there was no prejudice. And I would submit he withdrew within 2 months of the OLR starting its investigation. So I would submit that as long as there isn't harm or prejudice, and in this case delay, then what is gained by disciplining the attorney?
Well, that's another question. What's gained by disciplining this attorney? But But in terms of no harm and no delay, we have the findings, as you say, of Judge Erickson, you know, no harm here. And so that's a finding. But when I first looked at that, I thought to myself, no harm, no harm. Then why did client, I forget his name, the chiropractic client.
Lachlan?
Yeah. Why did Lachlan not want to have to jump attorneys midstream? Why? Because it's going to cost him a bit more, right?
Yeah, he never got charged a penny in this matter.
Well, and what about the opposing party? Don't you think there are a few billable hours that were racked up in terms of writing the letters saying, hey, you better get off the case? And I don't know if the Chavez has paid that. So it seems to me that we've got the finding here, and I don't think there's anything else in the record. But in other situations, you know, there's harm here, even though it was a $750 settlement and everyone went home.
Well,
other situations I'm talking about.
Well, if I suppose you always can second guess the referee and say there is some kind of harm in that situation. But you have to, I think you got to look at the big picture there as to what went on here, and the litigation went on. The litigation went on, so that whatever discovery had occurred wasn't lost to the Chavezes. You know, whatever money they had to pay for representation, the litigation went on. In fact, there was an amended complaint after Mr. Torvinen withdrew. There was an amended complaint, there was a scheduling order, and they eventually resolved the matter by settlement. So I don't think that the harm that you're talking about to the Chavezes was in any way material, because they would have had to do that anyway. They're the ones that initiated discovery. And let's be realistic here. This whole thing, like you pointed out, I believe, Justice Gable, it was to get these people to the table and talk and see if it could be resolved, because the darn thing was going to expire at the end of December anyway. And so, you know, this was an effort. This thing started out very informally, and it snowballed to the area. And I would bet you dollars to donuts, the only reason we're here is because the defendants thought they could delay the matter by starting an ethical question, a filing a complaint, because that would put the matter over. It might get the matter dismissed. We don't know that, but I would bet you dollars to donuts, knowing the people that are involved here. And so I think there wasn't a harm there that is in any way material. The harm was more to Mr. Lachlan, or would have been should he been charged, but he didn't. Mr. Torvinen never charged him anything. So that we're getting to the nitty-gritty of what I wanted to emphasize to you folks, that they really didn't, they being OLR, carry the burden of proof. They spend a lot of times, and a lot of time was spent here already, setting out their version of the facts. I thought that's why the referee was appointed to determine the facts.
Well, but isn't this more a legal question?
I'm sorry?
The issue of whether the representations were similar or substantially related is a question of law. So once the facts are set forth of who did what and when, then the issue is one of law, and we are not bound by what the referee said.
Absolutely. I understand that, Judge. But, you know, I'll bet it's been a rare case in this court, a private reprimand case like this. I imagine darn few of them get appealed in the first place.
No, that's not quite right. Many, or several, do. Because, like your client, the respondent feels that they're not subject to discipline because they did not do a violation. So it comes here. And then instead of being a private reprimand, the whole thing becomes public.
It sure does. And they take a big risk, just like Mr. Torvinen took a big risk in doing that.
And the court knows that and respects that.
And he submitted, because one of the things that occurred here was that the investigation over a period of time changed. And so he was willing to go before what he thought would be an unbiased fact finder and submit this case to him. And we did. The firm did, Torvenen did, and the fact finder wrote his report. And I understand that you don't have to accept that, but you don't have to ignore it either. This is a guy that had been on a bench a good long time and seen a lot of cases, and I would submit that his non-findings of fact, his conclusions of law, discussion, and recommendation are worth consideration by you folks. I see my yellow lights on, and I just want to emphasize one thing that I thought was really telling in what Judge Erickson said. And it's part of what you are just talking about, Judge, Chief Judge Abramson. He indicates at page 8 of his report, despite the modesty of the legal problem, respondent and the law firm spent untold hours in time and effort in defending the principles they strongly believed in. It would have been very expeditious for them to throw in the towel by conceding and accepting what respondent and the law firm believed was improper and unjustified discipline. They were justified in not doing that. I think that summarizes this situation along with his opinion. And again, I realize you don't have to accept this because it's not findings of fact. And of course, you don't have to accept those if you find they're clearly erroneous. But he goes at one point and he talks about, I think respondent Torvenen and the law firm should be commended rather than criticized and disciplined for the in this OLR prosecution. This is a guy that was there to judge. He heard the testimony. He saw the records. He filtered all that stuff using the standard of proof that's required. And after he did that, he arrived at that conclusion. And I just want to add one more thing. I think, in conclusion, not only should this matter be dismissed, but I think you should award Mr. Torvenen his costs and expenses in this matter. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Mr. Arnold?
Very briefly, since I know time is short, I would direct the court to the conflict of interest private reprimand 1993-7. This is on page 44 of our brief. I think that's a past matter that most closely parallels the facts of this case. That's 1993-7, page 44. And I won't take the time to read it. Very briefly, this court and all of the parties have the benefit at this point of a full record, including the transcript of the hearing. The referee did not have the benefit of a transcript. The transcript was not prepared until OLR commenced its appeal, a little bit to our surprise. As to the issue of timing withdrawal, I think that's already been well discussed. If you can cure a 1.9 violation by withdrawal, let's say 30 seconds before you walk through those doors back there, there will be no 1.9 prosecutions at any time if it can be cured by a withdrawal, no matter how tardy. The other issue I would like to discuss just very briefly, and that is the question about the sanction and a potential diversion agreement. As this court knows, a diversion agreement requires the consent of both parties, OLR's director and the respondent attorney. If no agreement for a diversion agreement is forthcoming from the respondent attorney, OLR's director must then decide to either dismiss or pursue a PRC cause to proceed to termination. So when a respondent attorney refuses a diversion agreement, that's the box the OLR director is put in. Thank you. Nothing else. Unless there are any questions?
If none, we conclude our proceeding on 09AP2007D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Kyle H. Torvenen. I want to thank Mr. Arnold for his representation of OLR and Mr. Hendricks for his representation of Mr. Torvenen. These are not easy cases for counsel. before for the court to decide, and the arguments I think the court will find very helpful. So the N09AP2007D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Tolvanen. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its last case. The students may remain here, and Justice Crooks will be out promptly. We are in recess.